Good morning. I'd like to thank Rich and Greg for inviting me to speak here. I've been looking forward to this. As a native Minnesotan, I feel like I should apologize for the weather, but something in the back of my head is saying we're really lucky it's not snowing today. So, even though I have a technical background as a hydrologist and a soil scientist, I work for the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency, and therefore I'm more probably as much a regulator as I am a technical person. And so I'm going to touch on the regulatory aspects of stormwater management. So I'm going to give a very brief overview of stormwater regulations and then talk very briefly again about stormwater permits. Permits vary from state to state. I'll primarily focus on Minnesota, but state regulatory agencies have some flexibility in different permits, but they're all basically very similar. Then I'll answer the question of how do you meet permit requirements through best management practices or stormwater control measures, as Ryan mentioned. And then we'll look at BMP design, construction, and implementation considerations with a focus on soils and engineered media. So as a regulator, I have to have at least six acronyms in my presentation, so I'll talk about certain types of stormwater is regulated under the National Pollution Discharge Elimination System, or NPDES, permits. Construction sites that disturb one or more acres are required to have a permit. Industrial stormwater permits are required for 29 different sectors. An example of a sector might be salvage yard facilities, for example. Municipal stormwater is also regulated. MS4 is maybe the acronym you're familiar with, Municipal Separate Storm Sewer Systems. I'm probably going to get one of these wrong eventually. But these are a little bit more complicated. They came in two phases. The first phase was in the early 90s, where the large cities such as Minneapolis and St. Paul were brought under permit, under regulations. And then phase two, which happened in the late 90s, were smaller cities between 10,000 and 100,000 were brought under permit coverage. And this can get pretty complicated. It took me about 3 years to get all of this right, but also publicly owned stormwater conveyances that occur within urban areas are regulated. So state colleges, state prisons that occur within urban areas, and if they own a stormwater conveyance, those are also regulated under this permit. And then, as I mentioned, individual state entities have flexibility in regulating different entities. In Minnesota, for example, if you discharge to an impaired water and you have a population of 5 to 10,000, you have to have a permit. So what are the permit requirements? Well, for industrial stormwater, you have to meet what's called benchmark requirements. So if you're an industrial permittee, you have to go out and you have to collect a water sample, and then you compare that to this benchmark number. If you fail the number, you have to do something on your property to make the water quality better, so the next time you go out and sample, you meet that benchmark number. And you have to keep doing this until you finally do meet your benchmark criteria. In construction stormwater, we've got this thing called the SWIP, the Stormwater Pollution Prevention Plan, and that'll detail information about what you must do while the site's open for construction. But we also have a requirement in our permit that post-construction, you have to infiltrate the first inch of water or capture that first inch of water if feasible, and if feasible is a key word. You'll notice the slate discoloration here, and I'll touch on why that is here in a second. Municipalities also have SWIPs. In this case, it's called the Stormwater Pollution Prevention Program, and within those, they have these MCMs. I think I've got my six now, but minimum control measures that cities have to follow. None of those are quantified, but if you have a TMDL, total maximum daily load, that is a number that you have to meet. And also there's anti-degradation provisions that apply to all permits. And in Minnesota here, that means you can have no increase in volume, phosphorus, or TSS if you go out and do something, if you develop a site. But when you're done developing that site, you can't increase your phosphorus, TSS, or volume to what it was prior to you being there. So this orange text, I'm not sure it shows up as orange, I guess it does there. These are places where we have to quantify activities, and that can be a problem for stormwater. For example, if you have a wastewater treatment facility, you've got one or two pipes, it's pretty easy to go out and it's easy to sample those. This is what a typical municipal storm sewer system looks like. And so we've got hundreds of pipes, hundreds of discharge points, And so how would you possibly go out and sample this and compare that to standards and determine that you're complying with the permits? Well, fortunately, you don't have to. You have this thing, I guess I do have more acronyms. Oh, good. You have this thing called a WQBEL. So what is that? It's a water quality-based effluent limit. And so what that means is in stormwater, our discharges can be expressed in the form of best management practices. We don't have to go out necessarily, collect samples and compare them to criteria. We can go out and put in these BMPs or stormwater control measures, and we have to link the performance of those measures to the discharge requirements. And so how do we do that? How does a permitting agency assure that these BMPs are in fact meeting their performance goals? Well, we do that because we link the performance of the BMP to the design, the construction, the implementation, the maintenance of that best management practice. These are all based on research and field monitoring that Ryan talked about, for example. I actually had somebody ask that question about the numbers and how uncertain they are. They're not as uncertain as you may think. It's through research that, like Ryan was explaining, we use that data from the researchers to build these design guidelines into the documents that I'll give an example of here in a minute. This is often called a crediting system. So by implementing a particular best management practice, you're going to get a credit or a reduction in some parameter. It could be the pounds of phosphorus, the pounds of TSS. It could be a volume. It could be a reduction in impervious surface. So if you put in a BMP, you're going to get a reduction credit. And those credits are tracked through modeling calculators and through a reporting system. So permittees have to report to us, to my agency, what BMPs they put in, and we have them do some calculations that show what kind of reductions they're getting as a result of the BMPs that they're reporting. Ryan touched on this, so I'm going to go through it very quickly, but I'm breaking these down into four general categories, the best management practices that we typically will give credit for. The backbone of stormwater management has been these ponds and wetlands for the last couple decades, and they're pretty good for getting sediment out, but we're finding that for impaired waters, a lot of times they just don't quite do the job. When you don't have the space, a lot of times you'll use filtration practices. Typical filtration practices would be swales, sand filters, green roofs, and some bioretention systems that have underdrains. But as Ryan mentioned, we're shifting increasingly to low-impact development, which is trying to retain that raindrop on site where it falls. And the way this is predominantly done is through infiltration practices, infiltration basins, trenches, bioretention systems, which include the tree trenches that Ryan mentioned, permeable pavement. And one that we're struggling with, and I think the Chesapeake Bay area is struggling with too, is taking a parking lot, for example, and disconnecting it from your impervious system and running that water over a turfed area. We know it works to some extent, but as a regulatory agent, we just don't hand out these credits. They have to be, you know, peer-reviewed, good research, good sound science, and so we're kind of getting squeezed from both ends about, well, how are you going to give credits for something like this? And we will someday. And the last one is chemically enhanced treatment systems, and we use these a lot for phosphorus. Ryan, if you remember a slide, showed that about a third to 40-45% of the phosphorus that comes off of urban runoff is in the dissolve phase, and you can't knock that out with traditional filtration practices and ponds, and so a lot of times we'll go in and we'll do chemical treatments to take out that dissolved fraction. This is an example of a credit system from Virginia. This is for bioretention basins, and you can see that you get for a level one, so this has got two design levels. If you design to level one, you're going to get a 40% volume reduction credit, and you're going to get a 55% phosphorus credit and a 64% total nitrogen credit. If you increase your design to a level two, you're going to get higher credits, 80% for volume, 90% for phosphorus and nitrogen. We have a similar credit system in Minnesota. If you go down the left column here, you'll see the different practices, infiltration, biofiltration, sand filters, and so forth. If you go across the top, you'll see TSS, total phosphorus, particular phosphorus. And so these are reduction numbers. These are those credits that I was talking about. If you put this BMP in, if you design it properly, construct it, maintain it, this is the amount of reduction credit you're going to get for that particular parameter for that BMP. Well, there's more than just these tables. There's literally dozens, possibly hundreds of stormwater manuals out there now. And this is where you find the information, the guidance, the design requirements. In Minnesota, for example, our manual, if we were to print it out, it's in electronic format. If we were to print it out, it probably would be about 1,500 pages thick. This is a typical page you'll see for bioretention. If you go to this page in our Minnesota Stormwater Manual, you'll see that it has design specifications, construction specifications, operation and maintenance specifications, and it also tells you what the credit system is, what kind of credits you're going to get. So each of those is an individual page that you could go to, and that would give you the information that you need about how to design and construct your system. Sometimes these pages also have special information. For example, we have a section in bioretention on amending your soil. That would be, for example, adding phosphorus to a soil, to get the adding iron to soil to get the phosphorus out. So what's the role of soil and engineered media? Well, Brian touched on this a little bit. Your infiltration rate beneath your system is going to be critical. So you've got water coming into this system, and it's going to pond up, and it's going to go through this overflow at some point, but you've got this ponded water in here. And it has to infiltrate. This is for an infiltration BMP. It has to infiltrate into the underlying soil. Well, if you have a sand soil, you can make this BMP smaller. If you have a finer textured soil underneath, you're not going to be able to infiltrate as much, and you may have to make your system bigger. Well, we work with developers all the time where bigger is not better. Smaller is better. They want to cut corners as much as they can. They want to build the smallest system because they'd rather build homes than in infiltration systems. So that underlying soil is a critical factor in the design. That allows you to size your BMP. Soil engineered media is critical to pollutant removal. If you look at this graph here, I've got four BMPs, got two, green roof and bioretention, with a media mix A. That mix you would find in our design criteria in our stormwater manual. You're not getting any phosphorus credit for these because these are media. These are BMPs that have a high concentration of organic matter in the media. These are just as likely to leach phosphorus as they are to attenuate phosphorus. So we don't give you any credit for phosphorus. These aren't BMPs that you want to put in if you have a TMDL for phosphorus. You do get credits for permeable pavement, about 45% removal for phosphorus. And if you use bioretention with mix C, which is a low organic matter media, we're going to give you a phosphorus credit of about 52 or 53%. So soil and engineered media does matter for pollutant removal. It also matters for vegetation. In Minnesota here, if you put a tree in your bioretention system, you're going to get an evapotranspiration credit. So to put a tree in your system, you have to design it a certain way. And if you do, and you get that tree in there, you're going to get a credit. It's not a huge credit, but it can be as much as 10 to 20% total volume for a system where you have underdrains, which is not insignificant if you're a developer. There are some other soil issues out there. One that we're starting to look at a little bit more closely is in cold weather climates. Road salt, you don't want high sodium-rich water going to a best management practice because it's going to disperse your clays, it's going to decrease your infiltration rate, and that is going to affect your credit ultimately. Reducing compaction, again, Ryan touched on this. This is a table out of our manual. It tells you what kind of reduction in bulk density you can expect with different types of practices. And what we've found in the literature so far is that the best thing you can do is you can amend your soil with organic matter and incorporate it with some of the techniques that Ryan was talking about. Amendments. So if you do want to grow a tree, you might have to have a fairly rich organic material at the top of your surface, as shown here. This has got 20% compost. Well, that could leach phosphorus. So what we do in this particular system is we design it so that at the bottom of the system we add 5% iron filings. So we've got dissolved phosphorus being leached out of that top zone, but it has to go through that lower layer, and the iron will pick up and sequester that phosphorus. So we're seeing more and more of these kind of, fancier is not the right word, but more of these specific designs to address particular pollutants. Turf management is critical. This is for that impervious surface disconnection. If you want to run a parking lot, runoff from a parking lot over a turf area, you have to design that turf area so that it can infiltrate and take the water. And soils, obviously, are critical. Occasionally, we have problems with soils that have excessive infiltration rates. This is going to be a problem for retaining pollutants. Your water is going to move through too fast, so you have to amend these soils. And so it's critical here that you, in our manual, we'll give you some guidance about how you amend these particular soils. Some example soil engineered media we have in manuals includes infiltration rates. So we always prefer that you go out and sample, and that guidance is in our manual too, but what we find most of the time is people go out and they'll take borings and determine their soil texture. And so when you do that, you can go to this table and get your infiltration rate that you use to design your best management practice. Soil hydraulic properties, this would be critical for calculating that evapotranspiration. What is your wilting point of your soil, your porosity of your soil? You need that information to make the calculation. Media specifications, if you went here, so in Minnesota we have four specifications in our manual, mixes A, B, C, and D, and I mentioned A and C. One of the big differences between them is the amount of organic matter in that media. So if you need to meet a phosphorus credit, you're not going to use mix A, you're going to use mix C or D, which are lower in organic matter. We also have information on alleviating compaction, because this is going to be critical to sizing your best management practice. And then also on soil amendments and so forth. Lots of information in these manuals on soils and engineered media. So I'm just going to go through a real quick example here. Pretend you have a soil, a B soil, with an infiltration rate of about 0.45 inches per hour. You have a 10-acre site, 5 acres of which is impervious. You have two permit requirements. First, you have a TMDL that requires you to reduce your phosphorus loading by 70%. But you also have this post-construction requirement that I mentioned, where you have to capture that first inch of water off your impermeable surface. Well, in this case, the more restrictive of these two requirements is going to be the 1 inch, because if you capture that first inch of water, you're going to do much better than 70% for your phosphorus removal. So the one inch is the number that we're shooting for in this particular example. Well, you could go out and just build a large infiltration system, and you can. This is from one of the calculators that we use to size these things. So you have your dimensions here. You can make it 10,000 by 10,000. So we got about a quarter acre. It's about 1.8 feet deep. And that gets us the volume requirement. That gets us 18,150 cubic feet. We need 18,000. It gets us 18,180. We need 18,150. So it's a well-designed system for that. But what if you don't have that kind of space to work with? Well, you can actually use certain BMPs and build them into your system. This is kind of a schematic that's intended to simulate the green line in St. Paul. Now, if you take the green line in St. Paul, you've got your drain here, but the street right next to it, the water drains from that into an underground system, and that water is stored. It doesn't get shunted off into the storm sewer system right away. It gets stored for a massive tree system. So that there's 6 miles of tree trench along the green line in St. Paul. The sidewalks consist of permeable pavement, and we could throw in a green roof just for the sake of it if we wanted to somewhere along the way. All of that gets us that 18,150 cubic feet that we need, and you can see, well, you probably can't see, but this also gets us an 81% reduction. I'm not sure why it keeps doing that. This also gets us an 81% reduction in phosphorus. So we met the phosphorus goal easily, and now we met our infiltration goal. But what if we're on D soils? Now we've got a rate infiltration rate of 0.06 inches per hour. Well, if you remember, the permit said that we have to capture the 1 inch of volume if feasible. Well, our permit describes those conditions which you don't have to meet that 1 inch. If you have less than 3 feet of bedrock, if you're in contaminated soils, if you have D soils, these are all conditions where you don't have to necessarily meet that 1 inch of infiltration. And so if we put in the same type of system that we had prior in the prior slide, we have a tree trench system, but now we've got an under drain on it. So we still have a tree trench system, but it's got an under drain on it. So we're not going to get the volume. And we're only able to achieve about 25%, but we don't have to get that 1 inch because that's no longer a permit requirement. But we still have to meet that TMDL, and that was a 70% phosphorus reduction. And so here, we're only getting 55% phosphorus. So one thing we could do to this system to get that higher rate is to put an iron enhanced media at the bottom of that tree trans system, for example. And if we do that, and then you go into the manual, our stormwater manual, it'll tell you what kind of credits you get, and lo and behold, with that particular system, we're able to get 70%, which meets our total maximum daily load requirement. So the permittee would send this information to us in their annual report. We'd look at it and we'd say, okay, you're meeting your performance goal, which is the 70% reduction. So just in summary, there are certain types of stormwater that are regulated through permits. Regulatory requirements are often, quantitative ones are often expressed as numeric goals, and to meet those numeric goals, rather than monitor, we go out and we put best management practices in, and these achieve a particular performance. And that performance depends on the design, the BMP itself, the design, the construction, maintenance, site characteristics, and so forth. And all that information, that guidance is in these stormwater manuals. Soil engineered media are really important factors to help you meet these permit requirements. One thing I hope I was able to convey was that actually more and more we're getting better and better information from the research community, and our toolbox is getting bigger so that you're not confined to building that large infiltration system. You can use other types of BMPs, and so we now have flexibility. I had one extra slide that I'm not going to show. I just wanted to really briefly touch on the importance of research. You'll hear a number of researchers today. We, as regulators, we need that research information. That tells us what kinds of credits, design, specs we're going to need, and so forth, to put that in the manual. So I'm really intrigued to listen to the rest of the presenters here today. So with that, I guess I'll take questions if there's time.
Yes, we have time for 3 minutes of questions.
And thank you for the comment. And short talks, unfortunately, sometimes skip over some details. You're correct. There are other, I did focus on iron. There are other things that can attenuate iron if you wanted to do them. Also, we're giving right now what we think is a fairly small credit for iron because the research is still out there. This is a small amount of iron that we're putting in these systems. They're being monitored, they're being researched, and we're not giving the kind of credit that we might get because of that type of information. We've seen some of these systems fail for some of the reasons that you explained. And so we're advocating for 3 to 5% iron at this point. We're waiting for the research to come in. And if the research shows that that's not the right thing to do, then it's not the right thing to do. But that's where we're at now. Yep.
My question has to do with overall performance. In other words, I understand the strategy you're using to give credits according to BMPs, and I know those are based on research information. But ultimately, somebody has to monitor something at the downstream end and say something about whether or not the totality of your program is meeting those numerical requirements that you. And I guess I'm curious, do you have those kinds of monitoring tools in place? And if so, have you done a reasonable assessment of that to look at whether or not this overall system you're using for some municipalities is working?
That's a good question. It's kind of a tightrope that we walk because a permittee, once they put something in their permit, they're bound to implement what's in their permit. What we do monitor is we do monitor receiving waters. And so we're keeping an eye on those receiving waters in the case of TMDLs. If we're seeing improvements or if it meets water quality standards, then basically we think you've met your permit. You don't have to write anything more into the permit. If we're not seeing those improvements, we have to go back to regulated community and kind of ratchet things up. So it is a tightrope that we walk. We don't want permittees We don't want to force them to do more than is feasible, economically feasible for them, but they do have to do something. We got to make progress towards meeting those water standards.
All right, and with that, we've run out of time. Thank you very much, Mike.